Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
In my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, I want to welcome author, researcher, lecturer, and an authority on the megalithic works of South America and the ancient elongated-headed people of the area. He has even expanded exploration to Egypt. He's made multiple appearances on Ancient Aliens and several radio shows. Brian Forrester. How you doing today, Brian?
Good. How about you?
I'm very good. And thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. This is some of my favorite topics, ancient civilizations, megalithic structures, and how it was all done. I'd like to know, what got you interested in doing this? What brought you to this?
Well, I've been interested in ancient mysteries since I was a child. Places like the Giza Plateau and Stonehenge, and locations like that. I got to go to Stonehenge when I was 16, and at that time there wasn't even a fence around it. You could just walk right up to it. So that was my first hands-on experience with something megalithic.
After that, what kind of brought you to doing your research? What was it that got you started in Peru?
Well, I've been a natural traveler all of my life. I've been to about 100 countries, just exploring ancient cultures and just how people live in the present day and in the past. And about 15 or 16 years ago, I just woke up one morning and thought, I should go to Peru. Machu Picchu's in Peru. Maybe I should go have a look at that. And I was just astonished at all the megalithic work that I saw that academics seem to ignore, so I started to start researching it and made multiple trips to Peru, and then about 12 years ago, I just moved here with a one-way ticket.
Now, it seems that there's so much misunderstanding and disinformation about the origins of humanity and how far back we go. There's been multiple cataclysms throughout history that we've had to recover from. How far back do you think, I guess, this version of humanity goes?
Well, supposedly Homo sapiens have been on the planet for at least 200,000 years. We have strong scientific evidence that the last great cataclysm took place around 12,800 to 11,700 years ago, which caused global destruction. And we see evidence of that actually in some of the megalithic structures. You see cataclysmic damage not done by an army or people, but by natural forces.
Now, how do you think we basically recovered from that? What percentage of humanity do you think was lost during, let's say, just the last cataclysm that occurred?
I think a very high percentage disappeared. And according to author Barbara Han Clow, who wrote a book called Catastrophobia, she thinks that after the cataclysm is when people started living in caves or other shelters of stone, and that's where the so-called caveman period began. It wasn't that our ancestors did that for 190,000 years or something. It's just that civilizations rise to a peak and then collapse, sometimes man-made, sometimes done by cataclysmic forces. And then about 6,000 years ago, humanity began to rise again, and that's where we have Sumeria and ancient Egypt and the Indus Valley civilizations and stuff like that.
Now, when you look at the building of some of these megalithic structures and some of the knowledge that it appears they would have had about the stars and the way the basically the universe works, it seems that they were extremely advanced. How advanced do you think some of these civilizations were compared to what we are today?
I think some were technologically more advanced than what we are. When you look at, again, the Giza Plateau and the pyramids, actually, I was just editing a video from a recent trip to Egypt. The precision is beyond our capability. And also in places like Peru, where you have the polygonal wall construction, that would be almost technically impossible for us because every stone is a different shape and size. And that's not a logical approach to building. That's shows you it's a very advanced civilization that simply built the way that they felt like doing.
So where do you think this knowledge came from? Do you think it was just naturally developed knowledge? Is it possible that we had help from off planet or another realm to get the knowledge to build some of these structures or help with them?
I think it could be both. I'm starting to lean more and more towards ancient aliens because, again, the level of technology is just phenomenal. Some of the techniques used would be like theoretical physics for us, and we supposedly are the most highly developed time period in human history. So, you know, either it was a quote-unquote Atlantean civilization or it had to have been assistance or construction done by outside forces.
So that being said, it's a good possibility that we had regular interactions with different entities, possibly off planet, for a good bit of our history, wouldn't you think?
I think so, yeah.
Now that's fascinating. Now let's get into about how maybe some of the theories of how you think. Let's start with how the stones were cut. It appears that some of our modern machinery can't do the job that they did.
No, that's true. A recent geological analysis of the Great Pyramid shows that there were three different or possibly four different types of limestone used, and most of it was not from the Giza Plateau. It was actually from Cairo. So that means the 2.5 million multi-ton blocks had to be cut from quarries near Cairo and then moved across the Nile River to get to the Giza Plateau. So that complicates things even more than we previously thought.
Now, do you have any theories at all on the actual process that they used for cutting these stones?
Well, again, I was just editing a video and I can see tool marks. They're like parallel at about a 45 degree angle. I think that was a finishing tool. So there had to have been massive saws of some kind capable of cutting multi-ton blocks as much as 40 plus tons. And then transport is the next problem because, you know, you're not going to be using wooden rollers in a place like Egypt where there are no trees except for date palms, which can't hold very much weight.
Well, yeah, that brings me to the transport. I mean, any theories on how they could possibly have pulled that off?
I think it had to have been levitation of some kind, because again, just to get across the Nile River, you'd need massive ships or barges. And again, where would the wood have come from for that? The only possible logical answer would have been from Lebanon, like the cedars of Lebanon, but then you have to get to Lebanon to get, you know, thousands of pounds, if not tons of wood to be able to construct ships of that scale. So I think it's, again, it's an out of the box kind of thing. It had to have been very advanced technology on a level beyond our capability.
And I've seen demonstrations where they've actually used frequencies and sound to move large objects. Would you think that could be a possibility?
I think so, especially when you take into account the granite and basalt and quartzite stone, because they're quite high in quartz crystal. Quartz crystal, will vibrate if an energy is put through it. So levitation is possible with those. In terms of the limestone, though, that's it's a little more problematic because it's limestone's mainly calcium carbonate. So that, again, it's a very complicated question.
Now, do you believe those in charge, those that run the world, know this information and they suppress it intentionally through modern day academia?
I think so. I think it's just that these subjects are so complicated and can't be explained, with the idea of a bunch of slaves with bronze chisels, that they, for a long period of time, they've simply been dodging these questions. And now I think they've mainly just gone silent because they can't answer them the way that the, with the logic they used to use. And that's why the future is up to independent investigation, because the number of us who are doing this kind of work, there's no control on us, basically. I mean, we're simply looking for answers to complicated questions, and that's more or less how everything is opening up now. It's independent investigation.
Yes, and that's why I believe, a lot more researchers are coming out, a lot more people are watching shows like Ancient Aliens, alternative sources to history, because they know that something's not right. Do you see this ever changing in the future? Do you see any changes happening now that you've noticed?
Yeah, it is happening now. I was just at a conference called Contact in the Desert in California, and there you had Eric von Daniken, David Hatchett Childress, and Graham Hancock, and on and on it went. Not only UFO investigators, but simply so-called alternative researchers. And when I was asked the question, "Are things changing?" I said, "Yeah." To the audience, I said, "You are disclosure of this ancient information. We're not going to wait for the governments to come up with answers, because they're still dodging most of the situations. So it's up to us to do it. And the more of us that do it, the more will be revealed and the faster this will all happen."
Yeah, and there is some encouraging things going on with disclosure overall. I question some of the sources it's coming from, but it is encouraging. But like you said, there's a lot of work to be done in the field. And I think it's fascinating that, how you've shown that it's almost impossible for modern day machinery to do some of the work that these ancient peoples have done.
Yeah, especially in places like Peru with the polygonal work. And then another site in Bolivia called Pumapunku, where you see no tool marks whatsoever. I was just there, I think a week and a half ago. It was probably my 60th visit, and it's such a perplexing sight that I'm slowly unraveling it, but it will take time. I'm just going to get my cup of tea here.
Sure. Don't they have these boreholes that could have been made by some kind of diamond cutting machinery?
Well, yeah, diamond technology was invented around the 1860s AD by the mining industry to do things like core drills to see the quality of stone, or where you find gold deposits and things like that. So that's relatively recently. But we see, especially in Egypt, we see plenty of evidence of core drilling happening with an efficiency way beyond what we have, or way beyond what a diamond drill can do. So again, you're talking about incredibly advanced technology with materials that we haven't reinvented yet.
And something else that fascinates me is the age that we're now recently discovering some of these megalithic structures in Egypt, like the Sphinx, that we're discovering. It's much older, possibly before the Egyptian society there.
Yeah, well, the dynastic Egyptians date back around 5,000 to 5,500 years ago. And Robert Schock, the geologist, and over 200 other geologists insist that the weathering, or at least the vertical weathering on the Sphinx, is from rain, like a lot of rain over a long period of time. And if you ever visit the Giza Plateau, it's desert. So they're dating the Sphinx at a minimum of 10,000, if not 12,000 or more years old.
Now, any ideas of what civilization could have actually built those structures?
Again, it's either the so-called Atlanteans or it had to have been aliens. People keep talking about a lost civilization, but we have no evidence of where they ever existed unless they're, you know, unless their cities are underwater or something like that. So we have to entertain the idea of aliens. And one of the most important things now is that a lot of the construction in places like the Giza Plateau is actually underground. So the pyramids are just what's on the surface, but the tunnel systems under the Giza Plateau are very extensive in solid bedrock.
Do you think that we're going to make any headway excavating those tunnels in the near future?
I've had access under the Giza Plateau by influential people. So I've been there and I've experienced, you know, what is there. Egypt is opening up more and more of its ancient sites, which is quite incredible because it's been secretive for so long with locked metal doors and things like that. But I've been in what's called the Osiris Shaft, which goes down into the bedrock 200 feet. We had to rent the Osiris Shaft on each occasion at the cost of $2,400 for 2 hours, but we had a large group, so it wasn't very expensive, but that gave us direct access to the underground system.
Now, what do you think some of the purposes of, say, the pyramids are? Do you agree with Christopher Dunn that it could be some sort of power plant?
I think they were energetic, not necessarily power plants, but I think they were energetic structures that collected and distributed energy. I think the function of the obelisks were to receive the energy, just like a Wi-Fi system. So the pyramids would collect the natural earth energy and then emit out, and then the obelisks would then collect them or collect that energy. And then the energy would be used in very specific locations, like Karnak is an example where you find multiple obelisks all in a line, like an array.
Now, any ideas on what this energy was used for? I mean, is it any similarity to modern day electricity?
I don't think so. I think it was more for creating a localized force field to enhance consciousness. More than something as simple as transmission of electricity.
Now, with the similarities of these pyramids and megalithic structures around the world, do you think they were used for similar purposes?
Not as much, because the only real pyramids, based on the definition of what the word means, are the ones on the Giza Plateau area. And it's not just the three on the Giza Plateau. The plateau area goes on for miles and miles and miles, and you have other locations such as Saqqara and Dashur and Maidum that all contain remnants of these ancient, very well-constructed pyramidal structures, whereas the other ones in different parts of the world are pyramidal-looking, but they're not as well-made. So they're not as cohesive structures as you find in Egypt.
think they served more of a spiritual purpose then?
Yeah, I think raising a consciousness, the concept of as above, so below. Quite often you'll have underground water running underneath the pyramids, and that would or could possibly generate piezoelectric energy, again, for enhancing the state of consciousness more than anything, you know, related to producing electricity as we know it.
And to me, I believe that one of the reasons all of this information is suppressed is because of free energy. They probably know of the knowledge that these ancients had. And, you know, our gas and oil industry is big money. You know, pharmaceuticals, everything is what the world runs off of. And if they this information would ever get out, that would end all of that.
Yeah, it would, but it would be a very gradual process, and they understand that. Of course, they're protecting their industry, but eventually things have to evolve at some point. The internal combustion engine is exactly the same. It's more efficient, but it's the same now that it's been for multiple decades. Air travel, planes basically look the same as they have, at least for passenger travel, the same since I was a kid, and they basically travel at the same speed. So there's no efficiency there. Some breakthroughs are things such as the Tesla car, which is mind-bogglingly complex and also simple in the same way. Its moving parts are very few. But now its efficiency and speed is better than any internal combustion engine. So we are moving forward that way. And of course, the military are developing phenomenal machines, especially in the, you know, the United States is number one in terms of that. But some of the aircraft, like the fighters that they're producing now, are just astonishing in terms of what they can do.
Yeah, and it's always said that the military probably has technology 20, 30, possibly even more years ahead of what the public sees. I mean, do you think that eventually we would see any kind of this free energy that was possibly available during ancient time?
Yeah, I think eventually it'll happen, but I think it'll be on a very small or kind of a small scale. Like it'll be a unit that you put in your house. It won't be a giant electrical grid that's going to be constructed by massive corporations, but small companies in different parts of the world producing devices which can be used on a very small scale. I think that's highly likely at this point.
And when we're talking about cyclical cataclysms, I always wonder if we would be facing one in our lifetime. Do you have any thoughts about that, or is it going to be much, much further down the line?
Well, if you look at the work of Paul LaViolette, who's an American physicist, he believes that the cycle of cataclysms is about every 13,000 years. And I believe Robert Schock believes the same thing. They have different theories as to where the destructive force comes from, but they both agree that roughly half a precessional cycle is when one of these, you know, somewhat natural cataclysms occurs. So we're due for one. Maybe in our lifetimes, maybe not, but I wouldn't be worried about it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you still have to live your life. There are some, concerning things happening with earth changes right now. But I do believe it would be a gradual process, you know, no matter what's happening. I want to shift gears and I want to get into the elongated skulls.
Sure.
Now, I know many cultures do use the cradle boarding is what they call it, I believe, to produce that result. But many of what you've examined are not that. Is that right?
Yeah, like many different cultures, especially about 2,000 years ago in all sorts of different places, like the Maya or different cultures of Mexico, Melanesia, Europe, different locations, the elite would bind their babies' heads in order to make them physically look different. And that has to be based on something. It wouldn't just be experimentation. But in the case of the Paracas culture of Peru, we have strong evidence now that the original people of the area were born with elongated heads, and then over the course of time, they interbred with normal Homo sapiens sapiens, and then over the course of time, they had to start binding their babies' heads because they were starting to look too much like us.
Now, you also see depictions of, say, Osiris or Akhenaten with elongated skulls. Do you think that they actually had this feature?
Yeah, I think that's what Akhenaten was trying to portray, that he was descended from Osiris, and that Osiris was a being with an elongated head. And that's why he especially did the depiction to some degree of himself, but more of his daughters, to show that they were descended from, you know, the kingly ancient class of people or beings.
Well, what are your thoughts? Do you personally think these were just what ancient humans looked like, or is possible that it's a hybrid type situation?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an off-planet thing that happened, that visitors came and interbred with the ancient people of the time, especially the nobility, and produced hybrids who were the noble class, especially in places like, I think, Egypt, and also among the Inca of Peru and other locations too.
And another feature that I find fascinating about them is many have red hair.
Yeah.
What do you think the significance of that is?
Well, red hair in a lot of cultures, again, it's a sign of nobility. So in cultures of Europe and the Middle East, red-haired people tended to be the higher class of people. The mystery is on the coast of Peru, where you know, supposedly all you have are Native American people living here, that the Paracas people who had elongated heads had red hair. So that genetically had to have come from somewhere else.
It's very interesting. Now, I know there was some DNA testing done. What were the results of the testing?
Well, the DNA testing is an ongoing process. So, I mean, it's going on right now as well. The initial results, we tested 18 skulls, and the maternal DNA of only 2 of the 18 turned out to be Native American. The rest appear to be from Eurasia, which is the Black Sea area. And then we've conducted tests on 2 more, and again, the mitochondrial DNA points to the same area. And now, fortunately, we're testing the nuclear, which is the paternal DNA, so we're waiting to see how that turns out. But what we're probably looking at is ancient subspecies called Homo sapiens paracas, which then interbred with Homo sapiens sapiens.
Do you think it's possible that this bloodline could still be around today?
No, I don't think so. At least not in this area. The Paracas died out 2,000 years ago. People talk about that in Europe, the royal bloodlines are descended from, you know, some kind of hybrid. That's not an area that I study. So I'm kind of focused on my subject matter. I'm not like a universal expert on every oddity that went on in the past.
Something that's also very fascinating is the Inca may not have looked as they're portrayed. It may have actually been a ruling royal bloodline. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Because most of the royal Inca died off just prior to the arrival of the Spanish conquistadors, which most people don't know. There was a civil war going on for 5 years in Peru, or what we call Peru, and most of the royal Inca were wiped out. And so the depictions we see of the Inca today are based on painters in the city of Cusco in the 16th century trying to find what noble people looked like, because the King of Spain wanted to have paintings sent to him of who these so-called Inca kings were.
Now, why do you think this is, you know, this has caused so much confusion? Why do you think that they are actually portraying these people as the Inca?
Well, again, it's because the Inca themselves were more or less gone by that time. So anybody who had any degree of nobility were the ones that would be portrayed in these portraits, just for the curiosity of the royal family of Spain at the time.
There have also been giant skulls and bones excavated. Do you believe that in our ancient past there were giants that walked the earth?
I think there were, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call them giants. I'd call them very tall people. So I'm a biologist by training, so I can realistically see people could be 8 feet, maybe even 9 feet tall. And of course, that's depicted in the Bible with Goliath, and in many, like many cultures in the world talk about giants. So it has to be based on something. There had to have been probably subspecies of humans that were very tall people that wound up getting wiped out by us, which is the nature of what we do.
I find it strange that that would be suppressed, that they had, you know, extremely tall people in our distant past. I hear stories of how these bones were possibly destroyed. Have you heard anything like that?
Yeah, there are lots of stories about that, that museums and or governments in different parts of the world destroyed the bones of so-called giants because they didn't fit in either with their philosophy, or didn't fit in with Darwinism, or didn't fit in necessarily with other belief systems. And, you know, it's convenient. If something doesn't fit your picture of reality, then you, if you destroy it, then it's gone.
Do you think these ancient humans possibly had consciousness abilities or even psychic abilities that we possibly could have today, but are suppressed through all the, you know, pharmaceuticals with the food and everything like that, and people not even trying to access these abilities?
Yeah, I think definitely. And the more that we depend upon technology, especially things like smartphones or things to record memory, then we're becoming mentally weaker as time goes on. I mean, technology is great, but when you depend upon it from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, you're starting to get into trouble. And you especially see that in the youngest generations who cannot leave their smartphone away from their left hand. They have to walk around with it, and they have to use it all the time. And it's like, that's addiction and dependence, and that's not a smart idea.
Do you think it was possible that ancient civilizations may have destroyed themselves with technology at some point?
Well, that's the basic story of Atlantis, that you know, the Atlantean civilization became so powerful and then wanted to take over the entire planet that they developed destructive technology that wound up wiping them out.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And when you talk about Atlantis, you know, how far back would your idea of Atlantis go?
Well, everything's more or less based on Plato. So Plato said that somewhere around 12,000 years ago was when Atlantis was destroyed. His knowledge was based on an older Greek called Solon. And so Solon got his information from the ancient Egyptians. And the Egyptians were the great recorders of history of the world as they knew it and explored it. So that's the basic story.
Do you think it possible that at some point humans were upgraded or genetically modified by some of these beings?
I think it's possible. There's a work done by a guy, unfortunately deceased now, called Lloyd Pye, who showed quite convincingly that you can't evolve from apes, because apes have 24 pairs of chromosomes and we have 23. So what happened to that pair of chromosomes? And so he wrote a book called something like Everything You Know Is Wrong, which is a brilliant read. He wasn't an academic per se, but he was a very intelligent man. And that was one of his great revelations, is that you can't jump from an ape-like being to a human being. It can't happen. And I studied Darwinian evolution for 4 years in university, and a lot of it is still problematic. It's not a proven science. That's why it's called the theory of evolution. It's a theory.
And there's been, a big explosion of talk about the Sumerian people and the connections with the Anunnaki and the possibilities of them either intermingling with humans or tinkering with our DNA. And we've had Zachariah Sitchin's writings. I mean, what are your thoughts on his writings and the Sumerian culture?
Well, I was only able to read about the first 10 pages of one of his books, and I don't get it. So that's a field I haven't gotten into, because for a number of different reasons, mainly that I like to study places where I can go, and Iraq and Iran and Syria are definitely not on the travel log for the forthcoming number of years. But once those areas stabilize, I've been getting more into the Middle East. I started with Egypt. I've been there 7 times, and then I've been to Lebanon twice and Jordan twice. So I'm starting to creep eastward. Next year, I'm going with a group to Israel for the first time. So it's getting me closer and closer to the ancient Tigris and Euphrates area. So we're planning maybe in 2021, if things are stable in Iran, we might go, because there are a lot of ancient places there. But Iraq is still a basket case, and Syria is still a complete mess. So, we'll see.
Do you have any plans on ever going to Göbekli Tepe?
Yeah, I'm going this September.
Oh, that is fascinating. I can't wait for that. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, apart from the age, you think it was also, some sort of advanced technology being used in the building of that?
No, I don't think so, because I've been looking at megalithic stuff for a long time, and I see incredible precision when it comes to Egypt and Peru and Bolivia and some places in Turkey and the Middle East. But Göbekli Tepe, the great thing about it is that we know it was buried on purpose about 12,000 years ago. We know that the one ring that you see there is like 1/30th of what it is. The Turkish government have no plans on further excavations, maybe from outside pressure. And the carving itself actually technically isn't that great, but it's one of those places you do have to visit at least once, because it is, it's mysterious. It's quite a recent discovery. It's blown the whole theory that civilization goes back 6,000 years. It's at least 12 now. So it's a must view location at least once. And then once I go there and have a look around, that'll give me an indication of whether I want to go back. There's some places I go or have been once, and it's like, okay, that was good, but I'm not that, it doesn't fascinate me that I want to come back, whereas other places are reoccurring, like Egypt. Again, we go once a year to Egypt. I think I'll find Israel very fascinating, because I'm getting more into study of the fact that the Bible is quite an accurate description of history. And there have been some locations I've been to where it's been, interesting, but I think I'll go, somewhere else.
What do you think of the possibilities that you know, our United States government have invaded countries, not just over oil, but for archaeological findings and possible technologies?
I think a lot of different countries have gone into other countries looking for examples of ancient technology. The Nazis of Germany supposedly did that in places like Tibet. And it's only natural to go into, if you're invading a country, you want to take the cool stuff that's there back with you, especially stuff that you're not familiar with. So it is possible that did happen. I don't have any real proof of it, but I think that's what invading armies do in general, is take the wealth, take the mysterious things out of a country in order to analyze, at least if nothing else, analyze them. I don't know about control them, but at least analyze what this stuff is and what it did, and can you bring it back and reuse it?
Right. And another very fascinating place that I'm just recently starting to look into is Easter Island and the mm-hmm. Easter Island heads. It's not just heads, are they?
No, they're full bodies. I was just there in November for the third time. There are 950 of them. A lot of them are buried up to their necks. Some of them are completely buried underground. So they are full bodies. And in the 1950s, Thor Heyerdahl excavated one of the biggest ones. It's more than 30 feet tall and weighs, I think, 80 or 90 tons.
Now, how far back do you think these were constructed?
Again, I think we're looking at two different ages. I think the Polynesians showed up 1,000 to 2,000 years ago, and they saw a lot of this stuff was there. Then they tried to emulate it, so they made smaller figures. So you have two styles. You have small ones that are maybe 6 feet tall, and then you have some that are as large as 30 feet tall. And so I think that's the Polynesians trying to copy on a smaller scale what they found.
Very good. Now, Brian, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Is there anything interesting and upcoming that you'd like to talk about before you head out?
Well, yeah, just that for the first time, I'll be going to Turkey in September and going to Göbekli Tepe, but also the underground cities that are located there. They're very fascinating because, again, some of them are 10 or 20 stories deep in the ground. And how were they done? You know, they can't be a natural system. So I want to look for machining marks and things like that, which is what I always look for. And then in January, we're probably going to India because there's a lot of evidence of ancient machining technology there that predates the civilizations that we know of. And then multiple tours in Peru and Bolivia. And then once again, returning to Egypt in March of next year and Israel right after that. And then I guess we'll see what happens after, you know, what else pops in that's curious to go look at.
And one more question before you go. Do you think that we will ever see the truth coming out of modern day academia about, you know, elongated skulls, the technology they used, all of the truth about our history? Do you think they're ever just going to come out and tell us, or is this something that we just have to keep researching on our own?
Well, we're simply bypassing them. I mean, with the elongated skulls, the DNA results were sent to archaeologists who simply ignored the information. So, you know, where do you go? You go to YouTube and you make YouTube videos. And the video that I made about the results that series of seven have been viewed more than 2 million times from all around the world. So all of this information belongs to we as humanity, not through some gatekeeper, which has always been the problem in the past. It's like, you have to have these results peer reviewed. It's like, no, I don't. I'm a scientist. I can simply publish it on my own and let people read it and look at it. And that's how we do it. We go directly to the people. We don't go through you know, universities or other channels. It's direct communication like what we are doing today. That's how it works.
Very good. And I look forward to all the research you're going to be doing, all the places you're traveling, and I hope to have you back on to talk all about that.
Sure. Why don't you call me in 6 months?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Months and we'll do this again.
Very good. Well, thank you again for taking the time to do this, and you have an excellent day.
Okay, thank you very much.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.